This is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right, continuation of the talk on Thursday night, 30th of October, 69, about bedtime. This is beginning of Channel 2 Right, and a continuation of the talk about bedtime, Thursday the 30th of October, 69. This is Viewers of Donald. Now, this is Channel 2 Right, and this is Friday night, the 31st of October, 69. Halloween, is this Halloween? And that low pressure from the Gulf is starting to rain now, just enough to hear, too, and out of sprinkling. We played a little bit of Kobe, and it turned out to be more directions on how to groom than it. We left Kobe out.
I didn't know that you really meant the woods when you said we'd take Pussy out to jump.
Well, sure. Where else can you find the logs? It's all she's learning now is really sort of a continuation of what Johnny was teaching her. Just to go through anything. I take her out like I did today. And
I could close it all. It'd make it a lot quieter.
Yeah. Just put her over a few. You know, we just sort of go through the woods, and anything that gets in our way, we jump over. tell you, I was a little bit nervous about that. You know, that one if I do it from one direction, I have to stop within about 5 feet after she lands. It's a log, and it's the biggest one we do yet. It's about a foot and a half high. I don't. It's that high. I'm not sure it's that high. But anyway, it's the biggest one she's doing at the moment.
3 inches.
And gotten so that I can tell. Usually within 3 inches, and sometimes exactly how high a jump is if I think about it. Without going up and measuring it. That log was about was about 1.5 feet.
Well, Bob, the woods was filled with all sorts of things.
Well, most of them don't much matter to a horse, you see. I discovered that the hard way. I discovered that in my first time out hunting. And they took off at a gallop through the woods, and I'd never dared do it. Just go cross country through woods, and anything more than a walk. And the first time I went out hunting, and we weren't even up with the field. We were more or less hilltopping the first time I went, just trotting behind them. And the places they go, and they just go down these slippery, muddy banks into the streams and up the other side, and never seemed to bother them, or the horses, or anybody.
Not at a walk?
No, not at a walk. I mean, they would slow down to a walk. You'd approach it at a gallop, and they'd slow down. You were supposed to walk through it, but usually the horses would get excited by the fact that the minute you see that the horse got to the top of the bank where he could gallop on, he would. And so they'd get excited, and sometimes you couldn't hold your horse, and you were going through these streams at a trot or a canter, on the rocks and everything else. And I was just astounded. I'd never realized the capabilities that a horse has, of what a horse can do in cross-country conditions. And so I take Pussy just wherever I can take her. And then this particular log, you jump it, and then there's a grapevine and another stub of a log. And if she doesn't stop, she can step on that stub, or she can run me under the grapevine. But she's got good sense. And it's not like it was 3 foot high, where she needed a bit of momentum and room to stop afterwards. She can jump it from a walk, and has done, that little one. And that's what she's got to learn. I just don't want her to ever learn to stop. To ever learn that she can stop and not jump. So I just keep her thinking that she's going someplace else. And if she does stop, see, everything she's doing out there, all these logs, she can jump from a standstill. And when she stops, we just go over it from a standstill. I just won't let her get by. She tried that out there today. There's one log that I'd start her off on because it's nice, easy, and it's out in the open. And so she can get up a good, we can canter over it or whatever we want to do. But I always trot her over it. And we ended up on this, and I took her over it. She jumped really well. She put some actual spring into it and actually jumped instead of just getting herself over. She really jumped well.
And she's pretty.
Well, it felt nice. Mm-hmm. Of course, I got a little left behind, but that's another thing. But coming back, she realized we were just turning around and going back over the same thing. She didn't see any point in it, so she stopped. And I kicked her over, and she heaved herself up over it and got on the other side.
And groaned.
Oh, yeah. She groans. I mean, she makes it seem like such an effort. It's a horrible effort if she doesn't want to do it. If she doesn't see any point in it. Terrible effort. Every ounce of fat on her becomes twice its weight. And she heaved herself up over it. And so we turned around and tried it again, and she stopped, and we had to heave ourselves over it again. Finally, one last time I convinced her that we were actually going someplace, and she jumped it properly. And I just slid off her and quit. Just got off her the minute she did it right and quit.
And gave her some sugar.
Well, I didn't have any sugar. I might have given her a bit of carrot.
You did one other thing. You led her over.
Oh, yeah, when I walked back, I just let her walk behind me on long rein and walked over the log. And she didn't even stop. Most horses will stop, and you have to stand there and wait for them to think about it. And she didn't even stop. She just jumped over it and followed me on.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Not just walk over, jump over.
Yeah.
Check.
She jumped it. Well, it was high enough for her to have to think about that sort of thing.
And you said this was important for a certain kind of horses.
These trail horse classes, especially the English trail horse classes, often have a place you have to do all kinds of weird things. You have to get off and open a gate. You have to open a gate from on horseback. You have to walk through water and walk over a bunch of logs and walk over odd stuff. And one of the things that you're required to do, you may be required to do, is to lead a horse over an obstacle with the horse behind you, like I was leading Pussy. And it can be up to 3 foot 6 inches in height. I taught another quarter horse to do that, to lead over a jump. I found the main difficulty was that sometimes he knew what was coming, and sometimes I had a hard time getting over the jump before he did.
Oh, yeah.
Because you'd have to climb over it, too, and he would just come right on after me. No stopping in him, and sometimes I was hardly over the jump before he landed right beside me. That could get scary. The rope wasn't long enough.
That's right.
He was a super horse, though. He was big. He wasn't like the little quarter horses. He was big. Virginia horse. He was 5 years old when he came, and I spent two seasons on him and taught him to hunt, took him to his first hunt.
Oh.
And he loved hunting. That was the best thing, to go hunting. He took to it just like that. And he would follow the hounds as if he were going after cattle. It nearly proved the end to me, but he just loved it. And I'd been out riding with on another pony one day, and I got kicked in the shin, and it splintered the bone. Didn't crack it, just splintered the top layer, and the doctor had taken some splinters out. And I had a pack gauze over that. It had stitches in it, and gauze over that. And I went hunting about 4 days later, the Saturday after that. Took Smokey hunting, and I was wearing these top boots, and the leather of the saddle, the stirrup leather, ran right across where I'd been kicked. And Smokey he was enjoying that hunt. And we were having good runs too, which settled him, because he would be upset. A lot of horses are, when they go out, they get upset until they've had a good chance to get a good gallop in and settle them down. But he was settled, and we came around a corner. It's all hunting through woods, and they cut rides and paths. They're usually fairly narrow, only one horse wide.
Uh-oh. And you asked the fox.
Yeah, this is fox hunting. And that you have what the usual system is, the master goes in front and the field strings out along behind him. And it's easy to lose the hunt because if you have to stop for some reason, like a horse refuses to cross a stream or something like that and holds up a group of the hunt, the rest of the hunt doesn't wait for them. They go on. And if they go around a corner and there's a split in the trails, you've lost them. Unless you can read sign pretty good. And there are a lot of people who never bother to look for the tracks. They just go galloping off and mess up the sign so you can't follow it. And we had come around a corner. It was in dense, snaky country. And the trail, the ride was curvy and twisty, so you lost them pretty quickly if you weren't with them. And one of the girls I knew her. Her horse had bolted and thrown her, and she was unconscious. And her father and brother and a couple of other people were taking care of her. So we went on, but we stopped long enough to see if there was anything we could do. And before we went on, well, that was enough. We'd lost the hunt. They were gone. We'd just seen the last rider, you know, heading off in one direction. So we went galloping up to catch up with them, and Smokey was keen. He was really going. And sometimes it was hard to get him to really gallop because he would get into a good canter, but he wouldn't go any faster. But he was really moving. He wanted to catch up. You could feel him just trying to go faster. And we went around a corner, and there was all of a sudden he swung left into a side trail, and my leg came back and snapped against that leather, and that horse and I did a sliding stop like nothing you've ever seen. Aside from the fact that there was a 3'6" coop built across the trail, wooden jump, that I didn't feel like jumping at that particular moment. That leather coming across my leg had made that leg hurt for the first time since I'd done it. It had never really hurt me, but boy, when that leather came across it, I knew it. And Smokey was steaming. He was so confused. He knew where the hunt had gone. I didn't. I thought they'd gone straight on, but he knew they had gone left. And he fussed and champed and snorted and cursed, and I was sitting on him cursing because my leg was hurting. We must have made a beautiful pair. A couple of the other kids came back and said, "What's wrong?" I said, "Well, the doggone horse thinks he knows where they went better than I do."
And he
was right. Unfortunately, when we did follow that path, we came up too late. They'd already backtracked. You see, they backtrack all the time. And you never can tell when they're going the same way you are and when they might be going the other direction. And half the time you'll end up meet them head on, which is what we eventually did. We finally found them, and after galloping around the country for a while, and the master walking his horse up, we were just standing there because one of the hunt servants. We met one of the whips that they follow the outskirts of the hounds to make sure that they stay together and don't scatter. And we met one of the whips, and she could do what I can never do. She could just listen and tell what direction a sound was coming from.
You listen for the hounds, don't you?
Well, no, she was listening for the huntsman's bugle.
Oh, the huntsman's bugle.
To see where they were. And I can't tell what direction a sound is coming from. But she could. And so we finally met them. We were standing in a sort of standing around waiting for them, and they came walking up, and the master smiled and says, "You missed a good run." I didn't tell him about the one we'd had. Well, it's not quite cricket to count the ones that you have going, trying to find the hunt instead of trying to find the fox. But Smokey is, he's fine.
saw Miss Pussy. Bible was pushing her, and she picked up her feet, and she looked just beautiful in the woods there. And I didn't know she could even. I thought she'd stop and walk over them. I was unprepared for her jumping over anything.
She's the one that's been saying the horse can jump all this time.
Well, I know, but I wasn't prepared to see her jump. You know, just take her. And from what I could tell, she handled herself very well to the log and shook her head.
She did, didn't she?
She just shook her head. She walked up, and that was when it was on a return trip.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, now that's Pussy. That's old Pussy all coming out. But you turned her just a little bit, and she didn't step over it, she jumped over it.
Yeah.
I thought you all went over there to read about it a bit.
Oh, we did.
And that was what Barbara told me at first. She showed me that at first. And then we found a tree that was just marvelous, and there's a little seat down by it. It was just as cozy as it could be. And I had Moby Dick. I was reading Bildad. And Barbara's on the other side of the tree with Emerson. And a little mist came up. And I thought, I'm not going to let this mist get in the way of this, what I'm reading. I got to this. Well, I was reading the Pequod then, the description. And Barbara said something about this. I looked around at Barbara, and she had her eyes up and looking at the sky. And I said, oh, it's not going to rain. If it does, I don't care. Do you? Barbara said, no, I don't care. And in a little while, Barbara said, but maybe I better go get the pad off of Pussy. She was thinking about the books. If it did rain, we'd get our books wet.
Now, what is this you say about your brother's taste in cooking?
Well,
he's not a normal human being.
Well, either he isn't or I'm not. One or the other. See, he has this thing about, he chides me, because he says that I don't know what I'm missing. I didn't used to like things like spinach and curries and stuff like that. And he would say I just didn't know what I was missing. And then he turns around and he doesn't like avocado. Now I think avocado is great, just with salt. Just put it there. And he doesn't like it. He just doesn't like it. And he goes into the kitchen, and when he thinks of a steak, now when I think of a steak, I think of a nice, big, I like it rare, and I like it not very fancy, charcoal broiled, just plain steak with a little salt on it. But not my brother. My brother's got to have a French pepper steak with a wine sauce.
Really?
Oh, yes. And I will admit that when he gets through, he has a work of art which tastes wonderful. And I will eat it. I'm not like he is that avocado. He won't eat avocado, but I'll eat his steaks. But
and
I just don't quite. Pizzas, too. He gets into the kitchen and he starts nosing around and he finds bits of cheese and he throws those into it, and he finds a bit of pepperoni here and he throws that into it, he finds a bit of hamburger there and he throws that into it, and then he goes around and searches and sees if he can find some mushrooms and he throw that into it. He works for hours on the pasta part of it, just rolling it out with his rolling pin, and it has to be done exactly right. There's this meticulous care and making sure the rolling it's exactly the right thickness, and then he puts all this gook on top of it that he's worked on and sticks it in the oven. And what you get is not something you can eat. Like these people go to the pizza parlor and get a pizza and eat one about 9 inches in diameter. You tried to eat that much of my brother's pizza. You'd never make it. It's rich. It just doesn't work that way. But it's good. Rolling.
Now we got more groom than Kobe while on the other side.
Yeah, we did. He is, There's not many grooms who want to take time nowadays. I think probably one of the few I've met is the Daly's groom, Kobe. He's an old saddle horse groom. About, well, I don't know. He's getting on. He's an old man. One of the last of the old Negro grooms. And he's proud of his horses, no matter what sort of horses they are. He talked about time, this horse of Mr. Daly's. And he'd look at that chestnut and he'd say, "Now that's one good horse. You take that horse." When I was really leaving for England, he says, "You don't need to go to England. You get time." Or no, it's Mac. "You get Mac, and you take that horse, and I'll go with you on the show circuit, and that horse teach you all you need to know."
That's wonderful.
That horse teach you all you need to know.
How about that?
That's wonderful.
And he loved showing. He loved the day, you know, he'd talk about the days when he used to go showing with the Mrs. David, I forget what her name was. He'd stand there by the stall with that stable rubber in his hand, and he'd talk about how the horses he used to groom. And he could tell you all the things they won. But I like to listen to him because he'd talk about his cronies, the other grooms, and how they used to stand around and watch the horses when they were showing, and sort of brag on them to each other. Mr. Daly thought he was a prize. He couldn't. He wouldn't allow anything to happen in that stable that would upset Kobe. He didn't want anything to happen. Kobe, because he thought Kobe was something he'd never get hold of again. Mm-hmm. And he watched Kobe doing something. I watched Kobe one time getting one of the ponies ready to go to a show. And he was putting on the leg bandages. He laid on the cotton wool. It's a gamgee. It's on a base. It's not just loose. And you have to lay it on just right. And Kobe just whipped that thing on. Just lay it right, just the first time. Hmm. And put the leg bandages on over that to help the horse's legs. And Mr. Daly would stand there and watch him and say, "You know, Kobe, you can tell you've been doing that a long time." Kobe grinned. He could. He'd just lay them on. He'd lay those bandages on, just and every one would be just right on down the leg, just even as it could be, till it got down to the bottom. So he'd been doing that for years and years and years. But he wasn't, you know, he never got stuck. It didn't matter to him that he wasn't working with saddle horses anymore. And he'd wander up and down the barn. He didn't have much to do. Because their horses were kept out part of the time. And he didn't have much actual grooming to do. And he started saying, "Hunters sure are different from saddle horses. I just never realized what working with hunters was like." But he had to get them ready for actual hunting. And that was when they really have to be spiffed up. And he talked about how much easier they were to take care of than saddle horses. And he said, you know, I could learn what to do for these hunters. You just show me, I can learn. So one day I was braiding a mane. They don't have to do that with saddle horses. And I was braiding the mane, and he came in, and he was standing by the stall door, and he said, you know, I can do that. I said, sure you can, Kobe. You just take it and braid it down the mane, just like this one I'm doing now. He says, yeah, sure, I can do that. And so he went in to another horse that needed it done, and he started on, and he finished it. And same time I could do it. My hands get so cramped, I can't do it very fast. And he says, is that right? And I said, yep, that's right, Kobe. That's right. He'd pick it up just as quick as anything.
But he just liked horses?
He just liked horses. He'd been left enough money to retire on by the woman that owned the stable before the Daily. And he stayed on because he just enjoyed working with horses. He says he wasn't too sure about those hunters when they first came in there. But Mr. Daly is the sort of person that a man like Kobe can work with. And they just got on. So Kobe stayed. He doesn't need the money. With saddle horses, he had to work. Saddle horses take a lot of time. That's why he used to sort of keep on about how easy the hunters were, because he was used to having to spend hours on a horse just brushing the tail and mane and oiling hooves. And well, you have to do that with hunters too, but with saddle horses, it's an everyday thing. Well,
you see now, Faye, Barbara's been holding out on us. I'd understood she hadn't been around. She just lived with horses the whole time. She's over there, except for one little one. Sorry. But it seemed like this morning she's seen more than she let on.
Dane Wilder.
She went home with Dane who?
Wilder.
Way up to Birmingham.
Oh, beyond that. Village near Great Whitley, near Starfoot, which is near Kidderminster, which is... Starfoot's enough.
Donald would envy that, wouldn't he?
For the first time I went, that was...
Her mother came to pick us up. And... bundled us all into the car. And she drove us home to the house. And she took us by the hill way. And you come up from Starfort. And you're on the main road, and all of a sudden you snake right, and you're in a lane that's just narrow enough for one car, and that a small English car. And it snakes up heaven knows what grade it is. I don't know what grade it is. Something like one, I think it's about one in, what the English call 1 in 6. And it snakes up the hill, past the old house where Jane tells me the lady somebody or other lives, who is a bit of an eccentric, and on up the hill to you through some woods and get up to the round the top, runs along towards the top of Averly Hill, and then it drops down just as fast as it came up, and at the very bottom of it, you turn right, You're at Townhouse Farm, which is the Wildey's farm. And the first impression is it's just for me it was so striking. It's a Tudor. House with the beam work, and it had at one time been painted white with the beams painted black, but the Wildeys don't like the beams painted black. And when they first bought the house, they spent hours trying to get the black paint off the beams, seeing if they could get it off, because they said it's not really in the character of the house. It's a modern thing. The house stands on the sort of against the hill with a little lane, you know, the lane goes in front of it. And it's one of these great big homes with two or three stories, and they're all on slightly the first floor is all right. It's nice and cozy. And they've opened up the fireplaces that had been bricked up by the previous owners. They've opened them up. You have these big, solid room beams and the sort of rough-hewn look in the room. And then the upper stories are all on different levels. There's a little step here and another one there, and a door opens into one room, and trying to figure out where the hall is. And well, whether you're going to end up in the master's bedroom, all good guessing. And then there's a little stairway is sort of rickety looking, very solid in actual fact. It sort of winds its way in what's supposed to be a straight line, but doesn't quite end up that way, up to Jane's room, which is up in the garret. And the hill drops away from in front of it, drops down to a stream at its bottom, and Aberley Hill sort of curves so that with some of the smaller hills around it sort of goes down in a they're at the head of a horseshoe is what it amounts to. And so when you look at it, you can get this view out that goes out over the river valley. It's all this open countryside, but it's got trees, which is something you don't often, some sections of England you don't see. The hills at least have trees on them. And then the fields, and the open fields and hedges beyond that. And Miss Wildey loves to entertain. We just went in and lunch was the only meal we were going to have. And she has a huge kitchen. It's just a great big enormous kitchen with a huge what they call an auger in the middle. I never figured out whether it's gas or wood or what those things are run on. They're different from any of the types of stoves we use here. And it's a kitchen that you can just make your home in. And that's what they do. They live in the kitchen. And the whole sort of family life centers in the kitchen. The radio is in the kitchen, which is, they don't have a TV. And they listen to some of the radio dramas and the music on the radio, but they don't ever turn it over to the pop station. And there's a big table that has filled with junk, in which she occasionally clears the cats off of, and in order to cook on. But most of the time, if you're not doing anything, you just sit by the table while she works in the kitchen. And she talks about the little delivery boy and how he reacted to the neighbor dog. Neighbor dog comes up and spends all his time at Wildey's, and he likes to grab hold of things. Some people don't know how to take him. And so Mrs. Wilde chatters away about the delivery boy and the dog, and she's knows everything that's going on in the village, but she's not a village person. She's not a member of the village.
Oh.
They aren't. They only moved there recently, and they aren't members of the village, really. And Jane loves to tell a story about village gossip and her father. That's a lovely thing. Because they used to go riding early in the morning before they went to school. And she and her father and her sister would go out and saddle up and ride before dawn, really. And one winter morning they were going to do this, and her father had his horse. This great big white horse named Great Horse. They call him Great Horse. He has another name, but he's always called Great Horse. And he's a huge white animal, and her father is a tall, pretty handsome man, really. And her horse got away while she was trying to get it saddled up. And it went galloping down the road. The lane runs right into the village, and at the corner where it joins the road is the churchyard and the house of the village gossip.
Yeah.
And Sandy went into the churchyard, galloping among the tombstones and snorting his way around. So Jane ran up across the field, through some backyards, and arrived at the churchyard and was searching through to find Sandy. But her father rode up past the village gossip's house to the gate yard of the churchyard. And she apparently woke up and came to her window. And the next morning, didn't take Sandy out the front gate. She took him out the back, the way she'd come. So she never saw Sandy and Jane. And the next morning, there was a wild story going around the village about how this woman had woken up in the middle of the night and had gone to her window, and there in the road below was this handsome man on a beautiful white horse just standing there below her window. Rode off into the night. Sort of like going. It was a place where I could just completely relax. It was like going actually home, instead of going to visit a friend. There's the conversation and the way Mrs. Wilde could look at people and talk about them and the stories she told like that.
Like
the white horse and the little things, but I didn't catch half of them because she'd be talking about village people and I didn't know them. Jane would just go in stitches when her mother was, because she knew the people she was talking about, and I could see part of it. I couldn't see it completely because I didn't know the people. Because she would say, "Well, so and so done this. Isn't that just like him?" And they had a sort of, I suppose if I hadn't been in sort of the same situation, I might not have felt the way I did. But when they were talking, they all knew what each other was talking about. And if you just relax and fit in it, in the swing of things, you could see what they were talking about too. But it was that easy sort of give and take between them. They all knew, all was sort of, it was sort of all, the whole of life from centered around them. It was all sort of a big joke that they were watching and sharing among themselves and saying, "Isn't this delightful?" and isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is what made me, I just, Because it wasn't the fact that I could go through their record library and find records that I'd never heard of except for my father. Like Hoffnung. Hoffnung. With his weird music festival. Or that Jane and I could talk and seem to be talking on the same lines and understand each other. There's something else.
Now, she was just like you at the school.
Yeah, she was on the same sort of course I was. She was, Jane was, she had a talent for imagination. Used to scold her all the time because Jane was very self-effacing. She couldn't teach a lesson. She'd go in there and think, "Well, I just," she'd come out and say, I know I don't know as much about this as some of those kids do. How can I go in and teach them?"
Mm-hmm.
But and she would go out there and she'd become one of the children.
Mm-hmm.
And they would just have a grand old time, and all the kids would love their lessons. They enjoyed them, and they just had, because Jane was one of them. And nobody could ever say that discipline was very strict or anything like that, but they had a marvelous time. And see, would if something came up where discipline was demanded, the first person she would go to would be Jane and say, "Now, Jane, don't go out with these children and sympathize with them. If you can't keep from being one of them, just don't go around them."
Well, now what's going to happen to a girl like that?
I don't know.
Half-timber.
Mm-hmm.
How'd they happen to get a half-timber to the house?
Looking. They wanted a place in the country. They wanted a place, an old home, an old house. And what was it Jane told me? She said that he'd been in Scotland before. They'd been up in Scotland. And they'd looked at several other homes. And they found this one. I don't remember the details of it exactly, just how they got it. It was Mrs. Wilde wanted it. She wanted a house that had character, that wasn't just a. She said she couldn't stand the thought of living in a modern box. She wanted the place. These black sheep on it.
Oh.
Black sheep out there?
Yes. They were the few places in England or probably anywhere in the world that just raised black sheep. But that would be just true to character. The whole place. But they want black sheep. They don't want white sheep. And their black sheep are beautiful. Jane just goes out and sits in the pasture with them and talks to them. She talks for hours. And they come up to her, and they all have a name, and they all have this character, you see. And she'll go out there, and she did this when I was there. We went out, and we just sat down, and one of the ewes, who was bottle-fed when she was baby, came up and talked to us for a while. And she didn't think much of me. She'd come up and talk to Jane. Took her a while to get used to me before she'd talk to me at all. But she was so pretty and so delicate. She made the white sheep look just doggone rough and heavy. Just tiny little face and tiny feet.
Now, does that mean the same thing with me if I said I went out and talked to the animals?
Pretty much. Visits. She visits with her pig too. She has her own import sow. Yeah, sow that they raised from when it was a piglet. And I've never been too friendly with hogs myself, but she goes out and there's a great big old sow rolling over on her back. Jane goes out and says, oh, she just loves to have her stomach scratched. Scratches her stomach and scratches her behind her ears. And the cat, that sow is so funny. She just rolled over. Her lips dropped back so that her teeth showed. And she just, in utter bliss, stretched herself out and grunted and talked and so how much she enjoyed it. And she had the scattiest piglets Mrs. Wiggly, Wildy ever seen. Wiggly. Mrs. Wildy said she'd ever seen. We went one time when I went down with Jane alone. We were gonna have to. They wanted to take them from the barn over to a pen across the road. And the old sows knew where they were going, but those piglets. It was their first time unattended. And they, first of all, they wouldn't leave the pen. And then once they got outside the pen, they were all over the barn, just finding a crack, any crack they could go in between. They got behind the gate and the wall and couldn't get out and refused to even think that there might be a way out and just lay there and wiggled and yelled. You'd pick them up by the hind legs and put them out where they belonged and they'd go scampering off and go right back in. Mrs. Wilde said, oh, they've never behaved like this before. She didn't try to apologize to them so much. She just said they were the silliest batch. They were the silliest batch of pigs she'd ever seen.
Well, you know, batches do differ.
They do.
Yeah.
She said this lot was the silliest she'd seen. And the night after supper. 1st of November, 1969. 1st of November, 1969. It's Saturday night after supper. Saturday night after supper.
1st
November,
69.
November 69. It's Channel 2 right, 625. Channel 2 right, around 625. Channel 2 right, around 625.
Yes, sir.
The report on Usher and Dimmesdale. No, that the only thing I said in that little thing I did in class was that the what Poe was working through in his thesis, or his point of inquiry, was the effect of Usher says that he's suffering from fear, and not the fear of the act itself, but the anticipation of the act. That he lived in dread that something will happen, and that if it ever did finally happen, it would unhinge him. It would destroy him. And that the scene with Lady Madeline, her coming out of her her coming to in the dungeon, is working this out as Usher. What he happens to Usher is not that he suddenly that he realizes that his sister has been buried alive, but that he anticipates her coming up. That he's so sensitive, his extreme sensitivity, anticipates every move that she makes, feels every move that she makes. And it's the terror that builds up as he anticipates this that destroys him, and not the actual when she actually opens the door and stands in front of me. Snailism is, we're talking before, he's a man who's only feels safe within the framework of his faith, of his creed, within the set lines of his religion. And yet has the mind of the sensitivity he's in a position where he's struggling. His faith tells him one thing. Own nature, his own sensitiveness, tell him another. Or not necessarily another, but in a different way. He's caught. He only is free for that brief time after his talk with Hester. But I'm still aside from the extreme sensitivity of their natures, you see, I'm still having trouble with connection between Usher and Dimmesdale.
I don't know, Barbara. It looks to me like I don't know the answer to it, you know. All I do is, just like you do, try to get into it. It's easier to criticize you than it is to analyze Usher, you know. You have that feeling, you see, about both of them, that sensitivity. But I can't see that you pursue that. You're trying to get something logical. You got a sort of analysis of something. You want to use your mind on it. You don't need to do that, you know. Once you perceive it. Emerson's not talking about mentality. He's talking about sort of a gleam of light. Just get me a passage or two, you see, of each one of them. It shows that. And I'm trying to make it rational. The only difference for me is I learned a long time ago that I wasn't rational. So I quit trying to be. That must have been on Saturday. Well, anyhow, here's a night or two ago, and this is Monday the 3rd of November, 69 after supper. Monday the 3rd of November, 69 after supper. And there were two little notes about Miss Pusey and Hubert H. Humphrey, and then we'll see what Ishmael does with cetology, classification.
Sure.
No, I got on to Hubert because I had to have Hubert before I could ride Pussy. And Hubert, I think, has a lot of character.
Vinny. On there.
Start alpha sentence without saying well and or er. Just cold like that.
Made the mistake. Didn't take the folder.
Let us tape him.
Just right now.
Yes.
Right now, yeah.
Count is ended.
On air.
I went to get him so that I could use him for Vivian, because I was going to ride Pussy out in the back pasture. And I went wandering out there without a halter. I figured I'd just grab hold of his forelock and he'd come along. It's a nice horse. He ought to. And I got out there, and he let me walk right up to him. He didn't turn around or walk away or anything. I told him what a good horse he was and what a noble animal. And grabbed hold of his forelock, and he promptly backed off. So I decided, well, he's obviously not going to let me lead him this way. I think I'll just get on him and see what happens. So I just got on him. And he walked off. He went over and started talking to Molly, telling her of all the problems. And if I ever, there's nothing feels sillier than sitting on top of a horse without a bridle or saddle or anything and having it talk to another horse and you not be able to do a thing about it. And finally, I just had to give up and defeat and go back and get a bridle so that I could ride that horse in. Could have taken one of the long weeds and put it around his neck and he would have come.
I bet you could.
I didn't think of it. But back, and we switched horses. I saddled up Hubie and we switched horses, and Vivian was delighted because she loves old Hubert. And we went out in the back pasture, and I sort of jumped Pussy over the things we usually jump. And the first time I've jumped her with a saddle on.
Already?
And she even after the work she'd had, she was feeling good. She was ready to perform. And I swear, that saddle, for one thing, that saddle doesn't have any knee roll on it at all. No place for you. If you get your knee in tight against it and it just slips forward off the saddle under the horse's shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
Between that and the fact that I haven't really done a lot of jumping in the last few months, I didn't, one day I felt like I'd fall off, but my hands kept coming up and catching her in the mouth, which I don't think she appreciated. We got over the first few, and she did real well. She's jumping. She's actually jumping and not just picking herself up and putting herself on the other side. She's putting a little force behind it and jumping. And so we went through the woods and met all the spiders and came around the pond. Back, went through the woods and then came back by the pond in the clear. No, we didn't either. Moved the gap. Came back across the other, went around. And over to where Faye and I had found some good-looking logs in the woods over on the other side. I took Pussy back there and she was all excited about it. I put her over one of them and she left me but good. She jumped and I was not with her at all and I caught her in the mouth. This is the only time that I really caught her hard. I told Vivian, you really seen an example of the worst today. Because I couldn't get with her in that saddle. And my hands kept coming up, so finally I had to just jump one log two or three or four times, and Pussy she was jumping it. She was doing all right. But you could see she wasn't liking having to go back over it two or three times. And she flattened her ears back and switched her tail. That's her sure sign if she's fussy about something. She starts switching that tail around. And, so I was with her a bit better. But well, it does if you just have to go so far to take things places where they belong, because you can't just leave them out. And one thing and another. Besides, I had to go catch Hubie, bring Hubie in, change his tack, or put tack on him.
And that was on Vivian's time?
Yeah. Well, it was beyond her lesson, but it was still in her time. Is your statement on classification sort of brought to mind Melville or Ishmael and his little chapter on whales? And he
the whale and a fish.
Yeah, this is on the idea of classifying things. And Melville just sort of has his little comment in about scientists who go on to the insides of a whale and classify him by all these little things on the inside, when he thinks that anybody can look at the outside of a whale and classify him. He starts off this grand design in this chapter on cetology to classify whales, he says he's going to do. And he starts off by arguing with the scientists, or saying they don't know what they're looking at.
Linnaeus.
Yep, Linnaeus.
He's a great name.
Mm-hmm. Great, great biologist and botanist and beginner of all these systems of classification. And Ishmael says that in Linnaeus' System of Nature, in AD 1776, he declares, "I hereby separate the whales from the fish. But of my own knowledge, Ishmael, I know that down to the year 1850, sharks and a shad, alewives and herring, against Linnaeus' expressed edict, were still found dividing the possession of the same seas with the leviathan." The grounds upon which Linnaeus would fain have banished the whales from the waters, he states as follows: "On account of their warm binocular heart, their lungs, their movable eyelids, their hollow ears, I submitted all this to my friends Simon Macy and Charlie Coffin of Nantucket, both messmates of mine in a certain voyage, and they united in the opinion that the reasons set forth were altogether insufficient." Charlie profanely hinted they were humbugs. He goes on to say that he's to define a whale as a fish because it lives in the water. And it's further to define it as a spouting fish with a horizontal tail. That's all he has to do to define a whale. By the externals, he says. But he goes on with this sort of attitude, this light type attitude toward it. He when he's classifying them, he classifies them according to size, and he gives them the names of the sizes of pages used in printing, sheets of paper used in printing. So the biggest whale is the folio whale, and the littlest one is the duodecimo whale, which are the porpoises and so forth. I missed that completely when I read it when I was younger, because I didn't know anything about printing. So I didn't know what these terms were referring to, and I just I took them all seriously. He takes the trouble to describe the whales fairly accurately, but always by their externals. From the outset.